Welcome to Blast to the Past podcast, a talk show where we revisit the media that shaped our culture. I'm one of your hosts, Landry Smith, and with me today is Tab Blankenship. How you doing, Tab?
I'm doing very well. How are you, Landry?
I'm good, man. It's been a good night. I'm in a good season of life. Yeah, we've just, my family's come off of like a bunch of sickness, and really that's the only downside, I think, lately. So pretty good for a winter.
It's going around. It's definitely going around. I know a lot of people that are sick. Knock on wood, I've been spared.
Well,
to this day, still never got COVID, to my knowledge. Wow. Now, if I was asymptomatic, okay, but I've never once tested positive, and I've only been sick twice, I think, in the last since COVID, and both times tested negative. So,
wow, you're one of the lucky ones, huh? I've had COVID so many times. I tested positive for COVID four times, and it wasn't like back to back either. It was like with it, like, you know, I went 4 years in a row. Around the same season at school, but you know, that's what I'm a school teacher, so that's what happens. It's just like it goes through the building. It's like everybody gets it, and then you're good for a year. You know, you've got your like your superstar immunity for a year, and then she's gonna come back around.
Both of my parents have RSV right now, which
oh my gosh,
is horrible.
Yeah, but it only affects like the older people, and then like very, very young, I think.
Yeah, it's like baby disease, right? Or baby virus.
Yeah, both my kids have had it at different times. Yeah. And it can be like various levels of severe. Like that's where like a breathing mask, like sometimes.
Yeah, they're both in week three of this.
Oh my gosh, dude.
Yeah, it's not good. They'll be all right, though.
Yeah, hope things go well. But we're not here to talk about diseases. Today, we're going to talk. Today, we're going to talk about Good Will Hunting.
Yes.
The film. Yes, that was made in 1997. That follows a poor Boston kid working as a janitor at MIT, but he also happens to be a self-educated genius. A professor takes an interest in his genius, but first, this Will, poor child, needs help from a psychologist before he can realize his full potential. Tab, was this your first time watching Good Will Hunting?
It was. I've seen clips here and there. You know, I know I've seen a couple of clips on YouTube. I went down the Good Will Hunting shorts rabbit hole, or just like where I got a bad habit of just watching like 2 and 3, 4 minute clips of a movie I've never seen. I just jump right in the middle.
I love it.
I don't know why I love it. I've gone down that rabbit hole. So
that's the culture we live in.
And then this movie has one definite, really big pop culture, you know, slogan, saying, line, whatever you want to call it, that just took off and was everywhere. So it has one, and you can argue two. So I was aware of those, and I was kind of aware of the basic premise of the movie, but I had never sat down and watched it start to finish. No, first time. I'm in my first timers club, and spoiler alert, I loved it.
I'm glad to hear that you loved it, man. I love this movie as well. And I did not grow up with this movie. I watched it for the first time probably about a decade ago, and this is my second time watching it, and man, it is awesome. It's even better than I remembered it, so.
That's good.
I'm curious about those two pop culture phrases. One of them, I would imagine, is how do you like them apples? Is that right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, like apples. Hey, like them apples, which in the movie, if I'm not mistaken, it's actually, do you like apples? I got her number. How you like them apples?
That's right. Yeah.
And then the other one is, it's not your fault.
But yeah, it's not your fault. Right.
Not your fault. Well, it's not your fault.
Right.
That one.
I didn't know that one had permeated into pop culture.
I don't think that had permeated into pop culture as much as obviously as you like apples, hey, like them apples, because that was on like SNL, probably like Mad TV. You would just see it on, you know, all kind of just references and you know, people like, you know, people you would know would say stuff like that.
Right. It's the first thing that people say whenever you mention this movie, usually.
Yeah. The other one's a bit more of a deep cut. You know, I was aware of it. And so me and some friends have been saying it for years, even though I've never actually seen the movie, but we've been saying it for years. So maybe this is just one that, you know,
permeated
your friend a little closer to home, you know, but I think it's a pop. I know SNL did do kind of a Good Will Hunting type spoof with the host was Bill Burr when he hosted, I think, this past season. And they had kind of a Good Will Hunting type skit. And that line pops up. But that could have just been an homage to the actual, you know. So we'll say 1.5 big lines, because we know you like apples, how about them apples?
That one's permeated. That's up there. I would actually like to see the origins of that saying. Like, is it from this movie? Because if it's from this movie, it's already like a part of the culture. Like that's just going to be a part of the lexicon for years to come. And there's some other things about this movie I think that will last for a while. First of all, it stars. It's got an incredible cast of just people who have made their mark on Hollywood. You know, Robin Williams and his Academy Award winning performance as the therapist, and Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. This is their first film, and they wrote the movie as well. Casey Affleck as well, also Ben Affleck's brother, first movie also. Minnie Driver, and then Stellan Skarsgård as well. And all of these people in this cast, I think, just knock it out of the park. They all play their parts perfectly well. I really found myself attached to almost all of these characters. And I think Stellan Skarsgård just plays a very good kind of like almost antagonist almost in this film as well. The movie's directed by Gus Van Sant. Do you know Gus Van Sant? Are you familiar with his
name
or works? Okay.
No clue.
So he was a big independent film movie maker in the 90s, and really big in like the LGBT community. He had made a couple of indie films in the late 80s, Drugstore Cowboy, about like these kind. It's kind of like got a what's that Darren Aronofsky movie about the two drug addicts, and it's just kind of like all about the throngs of addiction, the pains of addiction, and everything.
It starts with an R.
Requiem for a Dream. Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, similar. It's very similar to Requiem for a Dream. It's one of those movies you don't really want to watch more than once. But yeah, it's like it's about a couple who just kind of like gets addicted, and they do all kinds of like hold up pharmacies and like all these kinds of stunts to get like their next fix and stuff. And then he made a movie called My Own Private Idaho that was really big. But he also directed a bunch of music videos for a bunch of famous bands in the 90s and stuff. But then comes out with Good Will Hunting, and that one kind of launched him into the mainstream Hollywood scene.
Did he make any big movies after Good Will Hunting?
He made some good, like big budget movies. His next movie right after Good Will Hunting, like at this point, like everybody wants Gus Van Sant. Like he's the new hot thing. And he made Psycho, a shot for shot remake of the 1960 Alfred Hitchcock classic. And it was a complete flop at the box office, $60 million movie. It's a really interesting movie to watch now. It's a interesting idea, but yeah, it just failed. It was thrashed by the critics and audiences hated it as well. And then he kind of went back into indie obscurity, but he made some really good indie films. Elephant is one that sticks out for me. I'll never forget watching that. It's about like the Columbine shooting kids, but it's a fictionalized version of that. It's pretty good. But nothing I don't think that he's made since hit the mainstream per se.
Okay. Well, didn't know that. Couldn't have told you who the director was. You know, had no idea. I had thought that Ben Affleck and Matt Damon wrote this. I remember hearing I'm not sure if I'm getting this confused with Rocky, but were there rumors that they didn't write it?
I never heard any rumors they didn't write it.
Okay. Because maybe that's one of those things people just didn't give them credit for, two guys who come out of the, you know, come out of nowhere and just write probably the best movie of the year. But what's the year that like Crash won?
No, this is 2006.
Yeah. Okay. Way off.
I think 97 was a pretty stacked year, I think. I can't remember exactly, but. Yeah, they definitely wrote it. I mean, Matt Damon wrote this. He wrote the first scene he wrote was the scene between the Will character and Sean, the therapist, when they first meet each other. And it's the scene where Will goes over to the painting Sean drew and just kind of like critiques it. And basically just like really
He shits
all over the painting, but he also picks apart Will's or Sean's life, the therapist's life, pretty accurately. It's a really powerful scene. And that scene from that like acting class that he wrote it in stayed almost word for word. And it seems like everything else in that original script kind of got shook up and moved around. And that's when Ben Affleck came in and kind of helped rewrite the movie.
It's like helped rewrite it. Wow. I mean, one of my notes was, did this movie launch Affleck Damon? Sounds like it did.
It did. Yeah.
That's a great, I mean, they both gone on to obviously have rock star careers.
Exactly.
You know, they've been fantastic in just about everything they've done. Big ups to Ben Affleck as Batman. One of the most underrated Batmans, in my opinion. I thought he did a fantastic job.
He got a great Batman chin. I don't think I ever watched this Batman movie.
He does. Great Batman chin. Get out of here, Val Kilmer. Get out of here. Like, what are you doing? George Clooney? Hit the bricks. Like, you don't belong. You know?
I like Ben Affleck a lot. I know he's caught a lot of flack, I guess, maybe for his off-screen stuff. I have no idea. I've always liked Ben Affleck. I think he's great. I think he's a great director. I think he's fairly good in a lot of his parts that he plays in as well. But yeah, I think this movie for both of them was just lightning in a bottle. You can watch a lot of interviews on YouTube about like how they wrote this. And they basically were obsessed with the fact that Quentin Tarantino, just a couple years prior, had made Reservoir Dogs on like a shoestring budget. And Richard Linklater came out with like Slacker with just like a few hundred thousand dollars. Kevin Smith made Clerks. And they were like, dude, all these guys are just, you know, writing this stuff and coming out with these big movies. So they kind of like boiled it down to a formula, and they're like, we need to write a movie that we can star in, and that when we need to write a part for, like, they called it the Harvey Keitel part, which is like this Harvey Keitel plays a character in Reservoir Dogs that Quentin Tarantino got. Once he got Harvey Keitel, they were able to make their movie. So they wrote this part basically of Sean the Therapist to win an Academy Award. It turns out Robin Williams takes a very low pay to get onto this movie, and it's what wins him an Academy Award. Really cool story. Everything kind of fell into place, into the right place. But yeah, really good stuff. Weird. This is a weird like amalgamation of like a coming of age film and a psychological drama and a romance movie. It's got a little bit of everything though.
It's got a lot going on. And I've got one undertone of the movie that I'll get to a little bit later, but it's not what you think.
Okay. All right. So let's move on to some of the historical context of this movie. Do you think this movie is going to stick around in the cultural zeitgeist for a while?
I think so. Yeah, it's just that good. I mean, it's just a good movie, and it's hard to keep a good movie down. You know, if it's a five, but somehow catches fire at the right time and appeals to people and is popular, movies like that are going to fall off. This one is rock solid. It's entertaining. It's great characters, great cast, well-written. It's hard. It's going to be hard to, you know, take this off the social conscience. This is a really good one. I think of the movies we've watched so far, this is the best.
I completely agree. And I think there's two reasons that it will stick around as well outside of that. First of all, I think it might become Robin Williams' like most iconic performance, if not already. Like, it might be the thing that he's remembered for. And then secondly, it did launch the careers of Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. And they've had like a 25-year stint in Hollywood of like being relevant. And, you know, it's hard to carve out a big, memorable career in Hollywood. And then on like a smaller tertiary level, I could see this film being taught in film classes 100 years from now, like as a part of this 90s independent wave that came in, very definitive film from that period of people like Quentin Tarantino, Richard Linklater, you know, and even ending with like films like The Blair Witch Project and The Big Lebowski. Like the 90s, that independent revolution was really a big thing for movies, I think.
Yeah, I know Tootsie is a script that's used in a lot of screenwriting classes. This could be like a more modern Tootsie. I mean, this is up there. Yeah.
100%. And Tootsie still kicks around. I mean, it's got its own relevance as well.
Maybe we should watch Tootsie. This is the second Tootsie reference, I believe.
That's so true. Yeah, which is so weird, you know? Shouts out to, who's the actor in that?
Dustin Hoffman?
Dustin Hoffman, yeah, man. What a guy. Yeah. So historically, I think this movie's definitely going to stick around. As far as a film review goes, what worked for you here? What didn't work for you? You said you've got something you've been holding back on telling me, and I'm excited to hear about that.
Yeah, so should I just go through the notes real quick?
Let's do it, man. This is my favorite part of every episode.
So, Good Will Hunting, a synopsis here. Right from the jump, Harvey Weinstein alert. Right from the jump. It's like, opening credits, Harvey Weinstein. I'm like, hey, now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some like if you watch this on a streaming service, that may be blacked out in the future. Who knows?
It very well could be. And then you see Ben Affleck's car, I believe,
right?
Which might be the filthiest car of all time.
100%.
That car has seen some things and been through some things. You got the MIT math problem scene. Loved it. You have something about the car?
I was just going to say there's an even worse car later on in the movie.
The one that's gifted.
Yeah, the one that's gifted. That one's.
I wouldn't say that one's worse. Did you see Affleck's car? That thing had some rust spots, man. Like, it was more rust than non-rust. Like, it was bad. MIT math scene. That was just cool.
Yes.
You know, they didn't really dick around much. They got right into it. I would say within the first 15, 20 minutes, it was like, here's the problem. It's solved. Who did it? And, you know, going into this, I kind of thought that was going to be more drawn out because I knew that was the big, you know, the big kickoff for the movie. And I didn't know it was going to come and go so quickly.
Yeah, there's not a lot of exposition in this movie. It's really just, if there's dialogue, it's either really funny or it advances the plot. And that's what's so great about this movie. It's just every single scene is great and worthwhile.
Yeah. I'll say it's paced very well. Then there's the famous bar scene. And did you see the women in that bar? You got some absolute ogres running around that bar. I don't know what's going on in Massachusetts in the late 90s.
But it turns out you don't have to send in a photo when you apply to Harvard.
No, you don't. obviously Minnie Driver is introduced, which, you know, I can't really name a ton of Minnie Driver films, but right. I thought she did a really good job in this movie.
She's amazing, yeah.
Fantastic job. The friend group, the foursome friend group.
Yes.
Let's talk about this. Matt Damon, A-list celebrity. Ben Affleck, A-list celebrity. Casey Affleck.
B-list?
A-list.
B? Okay.
B-plus, A-minus?
I'll give it B-plus.
And then Cole Hauser is like the fourth guy.
Who the heck is that? And
Cole Hauser? I mean, he's not bad. He's been really? In a lot of things. Yeah, okay. He's been in a lot of stuff. You know, B-list for sure. You know,
I think he does a great job in this movie. I didn't recognize him.
Yeah. Absolute juggernaut. You know, those four in that pathetic car. That's, I mean, then they have a fight at a playground, which on a basketball court. That was a little out of place, but I guess he had to get arrested. And then we see our very first, which
wait, you skipped over something that I want to talk about real quick.
Okay, go for it.
Okay. The Little League game. Are we to believe that they just go to these Little League games for fun with their booze and they're just drinking and watching Little League and like really invested in these? Or are they there for a family member? Because never actually said, and I think it'd be just so funny if they're actually just there to like watch the Little League game.
Just to watch the kids play.
Right, and get really invested. Because they're like, they're like tapping each other. Oh, yeah, he's up to bat. And it's like, dude, is this what they're doing in their free time just to have fun? Bringing booze to the Little League game and just...
I will say this. I don't even remember a Little League game.
Are you serious?
What are you talking about?
It's the beginning of... It's what starts the fight. They're at the Little League game and they see the guy that they eventually like get out of the car to beat up. He's there with this girl that one of them knows from the neighborhood. And Matt Damon's character is like, I know that guy. It's Carmen, whatever. He's like, he used to beat me up in kindergarten, like regularly. And they're like, well, let's go mess him up, essentially.
I remember that. Didn't remember that it took place at the Little League games. My apologies. Soon after the fight, we get the first appearance of Dunkin' Donuts. And I thought this was going to be the one and only Dunkin' Donuts appearance. Boy, was I wrong. There's about 11. You say Dunkin' about
they
11 times.
Definitely paid some money for some product placement.
So now it makes sense why Dunkin' Donuts and the Affleck family have kind of still been things. Like was it Ben Affleck that was in a bunch of Dunkin' commercials? And then Casey Affleck hosted SNL and had a Dunkin' Donuts skit. Like, Dunkin' has been part of the Affleck, you know, fame for a while. So when I first saw the first Dunkin' Donut, like, I think it was just a cup or something. Maybe it gave him some coffee outside of Affleck or Damon's house. And I was like, oh, Dunkin'. Dunkin' makes an appearance. And then it's like, oh, there's another Dunkin'. Oh, we got some donuts. We got some more coffee.
I wonder it's if like it's a Boston left and right. Corporation.
It's very big in Boston, apparently. The long-haired blonde guy at the bar. Love this guy. Absolutely love this guy. Love that guy. Love the actor. He did a fantastic job. Couldn't tell you who he is. Maybe his one and only credit. Couldn't tell you. But I thought that guy was fantastic. He was hateable.
So hateable.
I think was what was one. You want a hateable person in that role, and that guy nailed it.
Dude,
long hair.
He would have made a great soldier in the Revolutionary War as well. Like, you could have just plopped him right into a Revolutionary War film.
Yeah. And then you get the famous, so you like apples, how you like dim apples line. And then he flashes her phone number for everyone to see and write down. By the way, it's 555-1294.
Have you called that yet?
Good luck calling that. One of the most generic phone numbers. I'm not a huge fan of the 555.
Right. That seems fishy.
That does seem a little fishy.
555 seems like a fake number.
Well, that's the movie. You know, that's the Hollywood number. It's always 555. You know. And I remember one time in Seinfeld, they did 555, but they put a little twist on it. They said, KL5, which years ago, you know, phone numbers would sometimes be like letters and numbers.
Right. I remember that. Like
KL5, which is still 555.
Right.
But they kind of mix it up a little bit. Then he's in jail. All's Skyler from jail. Okay. And this is one of my favorite scenes in the movie when she answers the phone which is a corded phone because this is 1997. Cordless wasn't catching on. That was the longest cord. Now, I remember being a kid and my mom, we had a phone in the kitchen, and it was corded, and it had like a 100-foot cord. And my mom would walk, like she'd have a phone conversation in the kitchen, and she would walk around the entire house.
My God.
And essentially cutting rooms in half, like with just like the phone cord, like you had like limbo to get from like one side of the room to the other. And that at least made sense because she was going to walk 100 feet. Skylar's phone cord was every bit of like 45 feet long. And it, she was in a dorm room. Where are you going with, like, why do you need that much cord? Like, right. Do you need that much cord? Let me see here. I wrote something down. I can't read it. The professor, Skarsgård, he had a couple moments that kind of reminded me, in a way, of the pilot of Airplane. Remember the pilot of Airplane was very, like, inappropriate?
100%. Very so.
When when the math problem is first solved, and Skarsgård is at, like, some alumni weekend lunch or something like that, little festival. Oh,
yeah. And his girl comes up and is like, into that girl, yeah.
Yeah, and then she asks him about something about, hey, how you doing? You know, who solved? Or, you know, we want to know. And he's like, it's the weekend, unless you want to have a drink with me. Not quite sure that's ethical.
Yeah,
and then really not. There's a moment where he is, I think Will is in one of the many psychiatrists. He's like, you're just churning through him. Like, he goes through like four or five before he finally lands on Robin Williams. And Skarsgård's outside of one of those meetings. And he's talking to the student. And he is laying it on, brother. Like, he ain't hiding nothing. Like, his intentions are out there. He is ready to go.
Right.
Like, and I'm thinking, like, okay, again, it's the 90s, you know, it's the 90s. That's how things were. You know, no one was calling the dean. No one was tweeting, you know, like it was just, you know, something happened.
Right. No, he definitely a little sleazeball.
Yeah.
Little sleazeball.
And then Robin Williams make an appearance, possibly the hairiest man on earth. Robin Williams. Oh my gosh, dude.
What? Insane. Definitely an underrated skill of his is growing a beard. I mean, this beard can't compete with that, man.
Well, let me see your back of your hands.
I'm pretty hairy, but like.
Well, not even close to Robin Williams. Right. Robin Williams had knuckle hair. Like, when you have hair on your knuckles, like that's when you know you got to shave three times a day. The knuckle hair and the arm hair. And you just know this guy is just covered in hair, like chest hair, just bursting up to the neck. Neck doing its best not to get overtaken. It is rough, man. I wrote it down. Hairiest man ever. Hands, knuckles, arms, beard, chest, everything. Man, just covered. Buddy relationships, tons of it. Just dripping. Buddy relationships, Damon and Williams and Damon and Driver. Like, those were fun relationships to see develop.
Yes.
They kind of happened, you know, in a great way. I thought it was really well done. I wrote down Minnie Driver, absolute sweetheart, very likable. I thought her character was very likable, super likable.
Yeah, and it's like a character you don't see in film very much. Like, she's just kind of fun, go with the flow, really funny. Yeah, just a really, really good character. Also, one thing, and I'm sure maybe this won't be the best window to talk about this, but did you notice how, like, when Matt Damon is doing the problems on the board or like just being smart in a scene with the professors, there's Danny Elfman's score is playing in the background. It's very whimsical. And it like it makes you just kind of feel like, wow, he's doing something really special. But then every other scene, the scenes with Robin Williams don't really have music. But the scenes with like Minnie Driver and his buddies are like set to like Elliott Smith or like college rock. And it just had a really interesting dynamic of like soundscapes in the back of these different scenes. I felt like there was like distinctly three different sounds for the movie. It moved really well in that way. And I really dug the Elliott Smith stuff.
There are no fewer than 12 Elliott Smith songs in this movie. Like,
a lot of Elliott Smith songs.
So many. Because I was watching on Prime. And, you know, if you hit pause, it'll tell you the actors and the actresses on screen.
And it'll tell
you the musician. And I swear to God, every time I press pause, Elliott Smith's photo was on there. Like, every single time. The man had so many songs in this movie. Here's a little fun one I realized as I was writing it down. I was really impressed with the chemistry between Damon and Driver. And so I wrote down cute couple alert. And yeah, my very next note is Matt Damon goes completely South Boston on her. He's abusive. The very next note. Like, we went from cute couple alert to
No, yeah. Well, he's got some issues.
Yes, he does. I wrote Matt Damon self-destructive. Absolutely self-destructive.
100%.
In this movie. And that's another one of the underlying tones I'm going to get to in a second. I'm going to skip real quick. Actually, you know what? I'm going to get into it. I'm not even going to skip it. This is the, obviously, on the surface, this movie to me is about a boy genius who has a great ability to solve math problems, which, by the way, is never really explained. Like, I would have liked to have at least seen a flashback to him as a kid in a library or something. Like,
there is a scene of him as it's a quick cut of a bunch of stuff. And he sits down after he sees the problem. He goes home and he's reading a bunch of books. There's a stack of books next to him. And he's like by a window and he's reading a bunch of books.
Okay. Must have missed that. You blink, you'll miss it. So
yes,
it's not just a story about a guy who's a 20-year-old super genius when it comes to math. It's not just a story about the super genius and his struggles. It's not necessarily a movie about, in my opinion, about boy meets girl. This is a movie about poverty is a mentality, because okay. This guy has every possible, he has all the skills to be successful, and he just cannot get out of the cycle. Like he just can't do it.
But there's an interesting parallel, because Sean's going through the exact same thing, the therapist, Robin Williams, going through the exact same thing as Will. But I mean, and he, well, you know, interestingly, he comes from poverty as well. So maybe this is just kind of a parallel or, you know, a different phase of life.
Yeah. Just, and then, you know, when Ben Affleck goes in and is his negotiator, we'll call it, for the job interview, which, by the way, Ben Affleck looked fantastic in that job interview. Like, how does scummy Ben Affleck get a tuxedo like that, or not even a tuxedo, but like a suit like that, and like groomed and just going in with looking like a 10? Like,
right.
They offer him $84,000 a year in 1997. By today's standards, how much money do you think that is?
I would go with 100, and let's say 170. This is off the wall guess.
Very close. $66,257.
Okay.
That's the salary they're offering a 20-year-old kid who knows math. That's what they're offering him. No degree, no formal training, self-taught, basically going on the recommendation of a professor who may or may not be
Fields medalist.
You know, you're right, a Fields medalist. That gets the girls going, let me tell you, because he was definitely trying his hardest.
Well, he tried.
He gets offered by today's standards, $166,000 and has no interest in taking it. Then there's kind of a big gap here where I don't really have many notes. So basically, we're now getting close to ending the movie. I was just like, I didn't want to write anything. I was just like, eyes like on the movie. It was that good. Like, if a movie's not really capture my attention, I'll write a lot of notes just because I want something to do.
Right. That's fair.
Or if there's a lot of stuff that's happening that's just kind of off the wall. But like, I think I wrote the most notes with Jurassic Park and Karate Kid. I think those
were
the
first
ones.
Hour in Jurassic Park, just to write down a...
You had plenty of time to write. Yeah, plenty of time to write. Yeah. Could have wrote your own movie in that first hour. But then Ben Affleck gives him the greatest advice he's received ever. Like, better than Skarsgård, better than Robin Williams, better than many directors. Like, the best advice he's going to get, which is basically, in a nutshell, you're wasting your life. If you're still living with us and hanging out with us in 20 years, you're a loser. Like, yeah. Don't waste your opportunity. And I thought that was fantastic advice. Hope he takes it. Spoiler alert. Not really. He kind of starts to take it.
I mean, right.
And then there's the great, it's not your fault scene. It's not your fault. And that scene really reminded me of, for the third SNL reference of the night, Sarah Sherman, who's one of my favorite on the current cast. She did this weekend update with Colin Jost where she was like a psychic. And one of the lines she had was, really aggressively says, like, don't fight against the breakthrough. And that's exactly what's happening right here. Like, Matt Damon, you know, Robin Williams is like, not your fault. And Matt Damon was like, get out of here. See? He's like, it's not your fault. He's like, oh, well, maybe it's a little bit my fault. I don't know. It's not your fault. And then he's like, it's not your fault. And then it's like, the breakthrough comes. And he's just bawling. And now they're hugging and embracing and just like going at it. And I'm like, all right, that's a nice, you know, kind of a completion of that relationship, you know, kind of came full circle. He finally got to him, you know. And then I wrote down Matt Damon finally grows up, gets big boy job.
Yeah.
And then he gives the Irish goodbye to his friends, which is what Affleck wanted. Affleck was basically
right,
like, don't say goodbye. Just like, I want to come to your house. I'm like, I want to come to your house one day. And you're not going to be there. And, you know, my Dunkin's going to get cold. And like, if you're still here, you'll lose that. And that happens. Like, that comes full circle. Matt,
yeah,
you know, Ben Affleck shows up, knocking on the door, looking inside. No one's there. And he's like, oh, well, I guess he finally, I guess he finally took that big boy job. No, he didn't. He decided to basically tell the big boy job to go to hell. I'm packing up my brand new car, which is about 40 years old, and I'm going to drive my ass to Stanford, all the way to Northern Cal. Yeah, that thing ain't making it past. I'm telling you right now, it ain't making it to Kansas. If that car sees Kansas, I would be shocked.
Yeah, he's going to have to go through the Badlands, I think. That's going to be tough. He's probably still on the side of the road somewhere.
For sure. Still broken down. He actually just set up shop somewhere in Oklahoma. You know, he's just like, well, I guess, you know, as far as I'm going to get. He has no way of getting a hold of Minnie Driver. All he knows is that she's going to Stanford. So I guess that's at least a clue. It's 97. There's no internet. You know, cell phones really aren't a thing. You know, maybe he can page her. Like if she has a pager on her, he can beep her. I don't know. I only know what his plan is. He's a smart guy. He'll figure it out, right? So he's just going to drive clear across the country.
She doesn't have a pager.
He basically makes the same trip Ralph Macchio and his mom make from like New Jersey to Southern Cal, which was something like 2,700 miles. He makes that from Boston, which is probably even further. I'll say from Boston to where's Stanford? Somewhere in Northern Cal. I don't really know.
I don't know. Sorry.
Very long trip. Best of luck to you. On what interstate would that be? I-40, maybe? I think he might take I-40.
If he can make the trip, he's not ever going to need to work again. This woman is going to be Harvard and Stanford educated. She's going to be clearing 166 a year.
And she's already rich, right? Didn't her dad die and leave her some money? And
that's a good point.
She had money. Yeah, so she was already doing fine. You know, and she's a smoke show. I mean, fun, you know?
I think he made the right decision. But he's already getting offered a base salary of 166 without a degree. So
yeah, and she's clearly shown that she can handle the abuse. I mean, if I was for someone who's so smart and has a lot going on, she should have told him to pound sand as soon as he got abusive. But nope, she's got to stick around and hope for the best. I mean, come on, that's nonsense. Like, if any ladies are watching this and anybody gets abusive, just pack up your things and leave. Like, you can
great
do better.
Advice, Tab. Great
you can
advice.
Do better. But that's it. That's the end of my notes. Ultimately, this was a movie about a 20-year-old genius who can't break out of the cycle of poverty.
There you go.
That's my synopsis. Yeah.
I like it. And a 40-year-old therapist who can't break out of the cycle of poverty. I really love the parallels between Robin Williams and Matt Damon. Even the shots of where Matt Damon lives is kind of like barren, but it's also messy and kind of run down. And you get a couple shots of where Robin Williams lives, and it looks very similar. Like, you know, he's got dishes piled high in the sink. Yeah. He's drinking every night. It looks like even his office is just chaos. You can tell he's not necessarily in the best space just with the way the different scenes are set up where he lives. And I think Robin Williams, for as little screen time as he has in this movie, he's probably only on screen for about 15 minutes. And he just, you know, he's a powerhouse in this film. He just steals the show. I also 100%. Really like the other character that I just, every time he was on the screen, I was laughing, was Casey Affleck. Like, he probably only has like 8 lines in this movie. I think he's so funny in this one. So really good stuff there.
Does he jack off into a first baseman's glove at one point or something like that? Doesn't Casey Affleck like,
yeah, I forgot about that, in his friend's mother's room.
Yeah. What the hell, man?
That was way out of left field, man. Also love a movie that has a credit sequence that's not over a black screen. Like, the entire credit sequence, if you are dumb enough to stick around for the whole thing like I am, was just a car driving down a highway. Matt Damon.
I cut it off. Was there an after credit scene? Like, did Thanos make an appearance? Like, was it anything like
that? No Thanos, no.
No Thanos. Would have made perfect sense.
Well, Tab, I'm glad to hear you liked this movie. What would you give it out of 5?
I would give it a 4. Four and a half, no, something like that. 5 would be a top 10 movie for me. And I wouldn't put it in the top 10, but I would say this is a really good movie and definitely worth watching. So a nice solid 4, 4.5. We'll settle on 4. We'll go the Star Search scoring method, 4 1/4 stars. That's what this movie gets, 4 1/4 stars.
4 1/4 stars. I love it. For me, it's a 5-star film. I'm actually a pretty tough critic, I think. There's not a lot of movies I give 5-star. I've already given 2 out in our first 4, so I guess that doesn't hold true at all. But they just so happen to be, I would say, those are 2 of my top 10 movies. Like, Jurassic Park, for full-on entertainment value. I think this one is mostly for entertainment value, but there's also some really hard-hitting emotional scenes. And there's one more thing I want to talk about. Speaking of emotional scenes, there's something that the 90s, we've gotten away from in cinema after the 90s that really bothers me. And that's like sentimentalism. I feel like this is a very sentimental film and they're not afraid to get emotional and sentimental. Like the whole scene with Robin Williams and Matt Damon, like it's not your fault. It's a very sentimental scene. It's been made fun of and parodied a lot. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think people are so afraid of being parodied or being turned into an SNL skit that things have gotten, in the 2000s and the 20s and on, things have continued to get more dark and more real. But pop culture, blockbuster movies have shied away from some of these sentimental scenes. I think the 90s were too sentimental, but I think we've kind of rubber band affected and now we're afraid of sentimentality in films, and I think we need some kind of common ground. I'd like to see some of that come back a little bit.
There you go. Well said. I like that. Yeah. It wasn't sentimental. There's a lot of emotion in this movie.
Yeah. All right. Well, that is all the time we have here today, but you can write into us at blasttothepastcast@gmail.com and tell us what you think about Good Will Hunting and what you think we should look at on a future episode. We will see you next time.